Hello, I'm Maura Gamble, and welcome to this episode of Sensemaking in a Changing World podcast. Join me each week in conversation with leading permaculture-related educators, thinkers, activists, authors, designers, and practitioners to explore the kind of thinking and action we need to navigate a positive and regenerative way forward, to myceliate possibilities and share ideas of what a thriving one planet way of life could look like. My guests offer voices of clarity and common sense. In this episode, I'm joined by Rebecca Leek, an educational leader who has found an innovative way to apply a permaculture lens to school education and supporting educational leaders. She's been a special needs teacher, head teacher, school CEO, and school governor. She's currently the executive director of the Suffolk Primary Head Teachers Association, and her ideas have been published in The Guardian. She's an educational systems thinker and innovator, and her practice as a permaculturalist informs much of what she does, and in particular, the principles of valuing diversity and the marginal. I really love this chat with Rebecca. Come on in for a listen. But let me begin first by acknowledging that I'm recording this episode from my hand-built solar-powered studio here on beautiful Gubbi Gubbi country. I'm surrounded here by my permaculture design gardens in a permaculture eco-village. The Sensemaking in a Changing World podcast is a project of the Permaculture Education Institute. We teach permaculture design, teaching, and livelihood skills online to people on six continents, who in turn localize and enrich it and find appropriate ways to apply the planet care ethics of earth care, people care, and fair share wherever they are. Before we jump in, I'd love to invite you to subscribe to Sensemaking in a Changing World podcast on your favorite app and to share it freely. And also leave us a five-star review and a lovely comment, because it honestly really does help the little bots find this podcast. Alrighty, well, let's turn to this great chat with Rebecca Leek. Permaculture informs your practice. And the conversation that we're going to open up here today is really about how do you permaculture education, rather than what is permaculture education or what is the kind of permaculture gardening in schools. It's how do you permaculture the education system? So welcome so much to the show, Rebecca. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'd like to begin of asking you that sort of introductory question of how did permaculture meander its way into your life and work?
I've always been a bit of a grower, which I maybe didn't, you don't notice patterns in your life, and then you look back and you notice them. And my dad always had an allotment, and he would grow food, and he was a GP, so he was a doctor, and he used to help with the ladies' allotment next to hers, and you know, that kind of work, little edge bit of our little subculture in our life was always there. And then when I was at university, I went to Oxford, and I don't know how common it is at universities, but I was quite unusual in, first of all, I had a boyfriend who had an allotment, and I just loved it so much. And then I got one in my final year. That's always been an undercurrent. I think I've also always sought a kind of a spiritual side to things. And I realized I was a Quaker in my 20s, late 20s, you know, the importance of just having a sit and a listen and a wait. And I think those two things combined have then meant that whenever I came across anything permaculture related, it all makes complete sense. Eventually moved to a permaculture design farm, almost by chance. We let the currents take us over here in the east of England. And that's when I really married together the professional life that I was developing as a teacher with gardening and food production and business, and kind of tying it all together. And it all started making a lot of sense and speaking to each other. So, yeah.
You know, it's interesting, isn't it, how the simple idea of an allotment can run so deeply in our veins that it manifests things. It's like this fertile ground, isn't it? It's not just about a little plot to grow vegetables. It's a plot to grow awareness, to grow community. Before we dive into education, how is the allotment movement in the UK these days? Have you got much connection with it? Is it they're more growing, or is, you know, how's it happening?
I see lots of allotments, and there are them around, and you see people desperate to get one. And so there must be some demand. My brother has one. He lives in Maidstone, in Kent, which is quite a built-up town, and he really cherishes his. What's, I think, really hard is people that want to go a little bit larger scale. And what's really difficult is getting yourself an acre. That's really tough. So, but there does seem to be quite good protection. They're definitely alive and kicking allotments from my experience.
Yeah, that's fantastic. It's rapidly growing here in Australia. And I know that we've been deeply inspired. When I first started the City Farm in Brisbane, it was the first one in Australia, well, that part of Queensland. There was a couple of others in Australia. But we were definitely looking to actually what was going on in the UK, because there was already a flourishing urban agriculture movement there before it came to Australia. So,
yeah, I think there are very little tiny micro pockets of urban agriculture here. See, I live in a little flat. We have a big bit of land, but we also have a little flat. And my flat has AstroTurf on its left.
Oh, that's green all year round, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's gradually repopulated. I've now got a worm bin out there, which is causing great consternation, I think, with my neighbours. And because I rent it, I'm not really supposed to remove the AstroTurf, so I'm going to gradually have to kind of destroy it in some form, but there we are.
Let's head across into the world of education. Could you just describe a little bit about where you are in the world of education? Because you've been a teacher, a head teacher. Where are you now? Where's your place of working in the education system?
I haven't had a particularly conventional pathway. I've always done a few things at the same time, and so did kind of community arts projects with music alongside developing as a classroom teacher. So I've taught, by virtue of being a woman dipping in and out of maternity and having to duck and dive a bit, Latin and English in secondary schools and psychology, and then, you know, primary school classroom teacher, art and music and that kind of thing, as well as standard everything. And then I was handed the SENCO role, which is what we have in this country, which is Special Educational Needs Coordinator. Mm-hmm. It was just so wonderful to be responsible for the most remarkable humans in the classrooms. It kind of opened up my eyes, really, to diversity, the strength of difference, how much attention we need to pay to those unusual humans that are telling us so much that many of us don't even notice. They're the ones that notice all the things. Mm. And also you end up having to be a system thinker, because you're within a school that's having to run everyday lessons for the middle group of children. And you're suddenly having to be kind of innovative and go, how can I make all these classrooms work just for this one or that one or this one or that one? And if you land it all on individual teachers' plates, they can't deal with it. So you have to start developing systems and kind of think about how you can work rhizomatically, maybe kind of sideways and into different classrooms, and you find your allies and you find the teachers that can do it, and you know, all those kinds of things. And it gave me that kind of insight into systems thinking, I think, as well as the riches of humanity. And so it really spoke to me. And so I ended up being a SENCO in a primary school, and then I was a SENCO in a secondary school, and then ended up being a system leader for SEND over a kind of cluster of schools, which is how charitable trusts work in this country with schools. They're called multi-academy trusts. And seeing that perspective across different schools as well was such a great perspective. And then I ended up doing a similar role in Suffolk when we moved, and ended up being a head teacher for a few years, which was the most glorious thing. Now I'm about to be the executive director of the Suffolk Primary Head Teachers Association, an enriching organisation that's there to support head teachers who have such a difficult but brilliant job.
So how many schools in that region that you're...
I think it's between 200 and 300 primary schools. So I'm not in any way responsible for their performance. Mm-hmm. It's a professional association which cuts across. We've got quite a disjointed education sector in this country, where we've got schools that are still under the control of the local authority. I could go on forever. All those schools that have become part of independent trusts. And it's kind of a bit messy and fractured. But what's so lovely about this association is it's for all the head teachers of primary schools.
Yeah, that's amazing. So you have the possibility then to be offering programs and thinking and support across this whole region, and to, like you're saying, myceliate or do this connective threads between them in different ways, because you kind of like got this bird's eye view of what's happening.
Yeah, and I was kind of asked in my well, it wasn't really an interview because it's a freelance job, actually. So, you know, I was asked when we were talking about the role with the committee, you know, what do you think you'll do? I said, well, I'll have to do lots of listening, won't I? I have to do lots of observing and listening and finding out, because everything changes so quickly as well. And we've come out of COVID, and what the organisation did before is not necessarily what the organisation now needs to be doing. But what is really needed is support for head teachers. It's a really... In this country, you know, it's very, very hard leading a school. The stakes of getting something wrong are so high that it makes it we get very stressed in the education sector when some statutory policy is changed, and no wonder everyone gets very stressed about it, and then almost overcomplicates it because if you get it wrong in an inspection, then it's really high stakes. So helping with all that.
Given all of that and what you know with permaculture, how are you conceptualising this idea of permaculture in education? How do you permaculture an education system, and how does permaculture thinking support you in this role?
So one very topical example at the moment, I wrote an article about being edgy, if you like, with the way that you look at your behaviour systems within your school that you're a head of. I mean, I have to be careful because I don't like to criticise head teachers and approaches, because there are often reasons why things are there. And as we will all know as permaculturists, you don't change everything all at once. So if there's something that's there that is maybe a bit old school or not necessarily perfect, it may be because they're doing something else first and then they'll get onto that. So you get behaviour systems in schools, don't you, which are the good to be green behaviour system. So if the child is good, they put their name on the green bit, and if they get something wrong, they go on the amber bit, and if they're really bad, they go in the red. And if you know about trauma-informed practice, and if you know about ADHD and the way that public, even if it's quietly done, it has such sharp talons, is what I say, for some particular children. And they're often the children that need the behaviour support rather than the 85% who don't need any of this system at all. And so, it was an article that was saying, well, if your system is actually only serving the middle group that don't need the system, well, then it's a useless system. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you think about your behaviour systems and go, well, who's it for? Well, then let's start with designing it around those children. And you'll probably find that all the silly putting bits of paper in pockets on the side of the classroom is just a complete waste. And concentrate on getting it right for the outliers, for want of a better word. And it all sounds incredibly obvious when you say it, but it is using that. Well, it's valuing the marginal. It's saying, you know, they're the ones that are telling me what I need to think about. I'm going to start with them, build my system around them. And do you know what? Beautiful, beautiful restorative practice or low arousal kind of environment where it's much calmer and it's more systematic. So children who are autistic and, you know, they will find school much easier if it's got lower from a sensory perspective, less shouting, much calmer, more routine, a bit of space, physical space, less words in their face. And suddenly everything calms down. And thanks to them, if we actually listen to them. So that's one example, I think, of how it can work really well.
That's good for everyone then, you know.
Yeah, and then everyone benefits, which is often what happens, is good send practice. If you start thinking about that, you know, dyslexia friendly ways of teaching, not having so much text on the screen, not asking people to look up and down from a slide, up to a PowerPoint and back down again. You know, if you start doing all the things that these wonderful humans that have got, you know, these quirks, so to speak, that are telling us, well, we end up doing a much better job if we would only listen to them. Yeah. and appreciate what they're showing us, actually.
Yeah. And so what kind of response are you getting by describing these ideas in the public realm?
This one in particular has really caught on. Lots of people have replied and gone, this actually, one person said, gosh, this is so good, Rebecca. This can be applied in so many ways, in so many settings. I was like, yes, funny that. and all the kind of neurodiverse advocacy charities and things like that would read it and say, oh, this is exactly what we need. And you just have to trust that these little waves that you make end up getting through. And often you don't know what impact you've had. And occasionally somebody will come to you, won't they, a couple of years, and they go, gosh, I've got to tell you that when you said that, that meant that I did that. And you just have to trust. But they generally do seem to be going down quite well. So, and I think it is a different way of seeing that maybe people haven't thought about in education, in the education sector. I think it might be a little bit of a, I think it is a little bit of a different way of thinking about things that has made people sit up and listen. There's a lot in this country as well about coaching and mentoring, that kind of more humane side of management and leadership, and I think that you know, that all sits together with it all as well. So I think we as school leaders are really interested in seeing that happen in their school, and they suddenly go, God, it's a village that's working. That makes sense to lots of people as well when we talk about that, and there is that already, I think, in the more forward thinking corners of education, I think, definitely. Yeah.
Taking these ideas and these perspectives and understanding schools and teachers, well, I know from here in Australia, already feel the pressure of so many different things to conform to. They've got all their, you know, their KPIs, they've got all their targets. Where's the edge between this a new approach of thinking and the kind of structure? Where does the change happen? Where do you start to open up the possibility for new possibilities as a leader in this space?
I mean, I've seen it happen as a head teacher, because you get time. You know, you have to go through a couple of years of cycle. And so when I stepped in at a school, about a year later, I gave a talk actually on by nurturing them, not breaking them, because there has been a bit, you know, you step into a school and you think, oh, this has got to be all redone, and I'm right, that's it, I'm going to try and get rid of this member of staff and that member of staff, and it all goes a bit ridiculous and maverick. Rather going, well, let's give it 6 months and observe and build relationships. And I called it the green manure phase, actually. You do a few little things, because I think that's what's so lovely about green manure, isn't it? Is that you actually see some life, even though it might not give you your dinner. It's incredibly heartening in that you know, you get given some land that is not going to do much and it looks a bit miserable. And so you just give it something and you go, oh, look, it's alive. It is alive. And so you just do a few little bits and bobs and you see these little green shoots. And you go, right, I've got this now. Once you've spent that time, and really what that really means is building lots of relationships with staff and families and listening to the children and helping, rolling your sleeves up, finding the music player for the Halloween party, you know, and then seeing you're there and you're really interested in that community growing and that everyone has a place around your table, so to speak, as a head teacher. And then once you've got that, well, then you have a platform, and then you start talking, and then you don't do everything at once. You know, you do some things. And you change some things. And I think a really powerful thing for people to see is systems that work. So, for example, if there are meetings that happen, and this is a no waste thing, because there are so many meetings that are such a waste of time. And so, you know, you have your, well, you've got to have a Tuesday meeting and a Thursday meeting, and this one is an hour and a half and that one's 2 hours, and everyone sits around it's a book look meeting, and so all these piles of books come in and we all look at the children's books and kind of decide something or other and write it down on a piece of paper, and just going, hold on a minute, why are we doing this? You know, there may be a tiny reason why you're doing it. You go, right, well, should we just make sure we're doing that bit then, and we'll just get rid of everything else. And so I might not be, I'm not saying all this is a permaculture thing, so maybe I should a bit more. Just putting into practice those, you know, those principles that say, well, where's the waste here in this system? Mm. And how can I get rid of the waste and really get back to what's really needed, so that we're trying to make a healthy thing happen? And I don't want to say there's a lot of waste in schools, because the government say that a bit and it gives them a reason to not finance us properly. So I'm not saying there's loads of waste, so to speak, but I think it's more about that kind of stacking function. We can get more out of things that we do. There certainly isn't lots of money, but yeah. there's a lot of kind of faff and extra layers. And you were talking about your teachers and KPIs and ticking them all off, et cetera, et cetera. And sometimes just going, do we have to do this? Or do we not have to do this? And that can be really transformative.
I'm connecting what you're saying now with what you were saying before about time, because if you're doing that no waste strategy and stacking functions, and then it opens up that space. That's where the new possibilities can emerge from, where that new lifing can happen, where those pioneer species can start to find root because there's enough space and light for them to actually grow.
That's exactly it. So I'm a bit. I will always, whenever I start anywhere or advise anyone, is how do you cluster your emails? So one example is there's an email on a Thursday, and if it can wait till the Thursday email, it's going on the Thursday email. And as you say, as the workload starts becoming more sensible and purposeful, then you start seeing teachers that go, gosh, I can run a drama club. And, oh, Rebecca, I was wondering if, whereas before there's overwhelm.
Yeah.
And then suddenly they go, oh, no, well, I don't need to worry about that because I've done the Google form and it's just happened. So now I can actually get on with the fun. It is that, definitely.
Yeah. And I heard you say before that you were originally trained in music and did community arts. The thing you just mentioned, arts, my mind went there, and I'd love to hear about how community arts and education and permaculture could all combine.
Yeah, I don't know is the answer to that, because it's quite a long time ago for me. So I went to music school and did, I went on a bit of a route of I'm a capable musician at the age of 13 and did my grade 8 and all that kind of thing. And you end up being swept into that. Because you get into an orchestra and they say, well, you're a flute player and you just kind of do what you're told. From a temperament perspective, I don't think it was particularly the right thing for me. But when I left the Guildhall, so I did a master's at the Guildhall in kind of community music, really, which involved a bit of composition, a bit of performance and collaborating with, the drama students and doing some on stage music with drama production, that kind of cross arts thing. And so then when I was living in a place called Letchworth, which is quite an interesting town, it was a garden city, I kind of ended up with a community interest company that had an art gallery. And we would have an artist residency every month, and they would get a wall that they would have to kind of do something cool with, as well as having an exhibition of their work. But it was also a cafe so that we could pay the rent. And then in the evenings, it would have things like Folky Schmokey was one of the evenings where people would come and like jam and play folk music. And it was used as a little bit of a venue sometimes. So it was a bit of a interstitial point, if you like, of crossover of creatives. We had creatives breakfast. That was good fun. People would come who were maybe setting up a new business or in the arts and, a writer or a choreographer or something like that. And we'd have a breakfast, and some of those conversations, you don't know where they went, but what you knew that there were some fireworks really somewhere, little fizzes that would go off, and then some things would grow out of it. And using the outdoor space, I really learned about that, because we had a tiny gallery. We did move to a bigger space. We had a really tiny one, but we were on this little pedestrianised street with cherry trees outside. And the kind of what we had to do creatively to have kind of little art festivals. We did one with, there's a book called Rabbitiness by Joe Empson, which is a beautiful book about losing somebody actually in grief. And there's the artwork in it, these like didgeridoos actually, and painted trees, and it's all very splashy paint and music and everything. And we wrapped the trees in paper, and the children over the day painted the trees. So yeah, I kind of did all that too. So that kind of creative cross fertilization of people that want to create something beautiful just for the sake of it. So it was very enriching. Yeah.
And so a key part of a permaculture approach is too about this making connections and building relationships between things rather than having like an element and an element. And so if you're thinking about, oh, well, there's a school here and a school here and a theatre there and this, it's like, how do they, or, a garden, how do they come together? So I wonder, you've talked a lot about relationship building and, being in the role that you are now, like how might that approach of creating a container for that meeting happen. Yeah. How do you envisage being able to bring people together to imagine the possibilities that they have, rather than you imagine the possibilities, but, you know, we know that it's not until they also imagine the possibilities that it's going to go out. So tangibly, how do you think, because I'm imagining for teachers listening to this, they're going, yes, but how do we do it? What do we do? What do we do, yeah. Rebecca?
I do have some ideas, but I haven't quite started the job yet. So, you know, but one of the things that's fantastic about Suffolk, and I will say this because I'm a trustee, but that it is a brilliant organisation, is the Suffolk Libraries. And Suffolk Libraries is not run by the local authority like a lot of our library models. So what happened 10 years ago is that there was a bit of a question over the future of the libraries, and a group of very pioneering people said, well, what we'll do is we'll set up a charitable company and we will commission the local authority, so we will take your money that is maybe not enough, but we'll do our best with it, and run the library service. Mm-hmm. And that was 10 years ago, and it's been incredibly successful, and I'm very privileged to be a trustee. And so you know, one potential is that there are 40 odd libraries across Suffolk. There are 250 primary schools. I've made both those numbers up slightly, they're roughly speaking. And to create partnerships between genuine partnerships. So there's kind of, you know, links and maybes and everything, but genuinely make connections between these libraries that they're such an amazing resource, and they're very intergenerational as well. Libraries already some arts, you know, lovely arts projects, and they're starting to use their outdoor spaces as well in the libraries. And one of them, permaculture designed, actually in Stone Market. So if you're near Stone Market in Suffolk, it's definitely worth a visit with art. And that was a big collaborative project with artists as well. And then that really feeds into a healthy community. The libraries genuinely support healthy community in their towns and their little hubs that they put up. And so if the primary schools, or if a couple of primary schools were kind of twinned, or genuinely there was a partnership in arts or outdoor growing partnership, which then became intergenerational, as well, I think something like that would be so exciting. And the other thing is that, you know, all schools are different and they have different things in their locality. So the school where I was head teacher, over the road, so lucky, there was a bowls club, and there was the most incredibly beautiful town park called Holy Wells Park, with mature trees and water and everything, absolutely amazing. I think one of the projects might real genuine community connection between what's so alive right there on the edge of the school, just helping facilitate. You know, I am certainly not going to be in a position to tell head teachers what to do or what to do with their school, but to highlight and entangle is a word that keeps coming back to me at the moment, is kind of facilitate some entanglement on their edges, you know, who are their neighbours and what's right there. And I think there's huge potential. Often we find people go, oh, I know, let's make a community hub. And there's already one. So there's the library already. So it's having that local knowledge and really being on top of that and making sure I'm connected and know what's going on, to then go, do you know what? You just need to connect with them. And then off we go. I would hope, anyway. I'm in a hopeful phase of that one.
Yeah, that's so wonderful. And I think exactly what you're saying too is that it being extremely localized, that by being observant and connecting with what's in place, that there's not a one size fits all. I guess is what I'm trying to say, that it is about being deeply connected and observant about what's going on around you. And I love how you describe that, with that, what's alive? Where is that aliveness in and around where you are, and how do you nurture and feed and compost that entanglement in a way that it does keep growing new sprouts and keep composting itself, you know, becoming a self-composting system.
And once the community is engaged with the school, and that there's faith, when the faith is there from the parents, then that's when health really, the school becomes really healthy, and it then becomes self-generating. So the school that I was at the head, that I was the head of, I really wanted somebody to be trained in forest schools, and because of, well, for lots of reasons, not just me, you know, there were other individuals and the people that came to me, but, you know, because of the relationships and the openness to professional development that had developed as a culture, you know, they came to me and they said, oh, I'd really like to train as a forest school teacher. And it's like, there's an opportunity. And now one of the governors, who was also happened to have been training as a forest school teacher, make that connection, boom, boom, boom. And so the site has really developed since I've been there, actually. They've really run with it. And now there's a preschool group that runs a forest school preschool group on a Thursday or something, you know, at 2 o'clock, which that's the health of a school community going, oh, there's a gap there. Oh, I can just fill that. And then somebody and then somebody. And it just starts. It's the unleashing of the life of a real live community that's so exciting. Yeah.
So it sounds, you know, there are some core principles and practices that can support the work that you're doing. And I wonder, will you be doing sort of like professional development, eco-literacy thinking, permaculture thinking, systems thinking with the teachers, or is it just kind of like dropping little seeds here and there?
Well, if they'll have me and if they'll listen, then yes, I would love to. I've got a little book on the boil, possibly called something like Permaculture Unmuddied, which is about using almost disapplied, you know, kind of going back to the real principles of permaculture and seeing how it can inform organisational leadership and community development. Probably for head teachers. So maybe someone will read that. Maybe I'll write it. Maybe someone will read it. But yes, I mean, I already speak at some conferences and it always crops up. Governance, because we've got whole governance around schools. And when do you check and when do you leave it? Mm-hmm. And that kind of thing is another really interesting one. So yes, I'm in a bit of a limbo state because mm-hmm. I don't quite know what I'll be able to do. But if anyone ever wants me, then I'll always do it. And I am increasingly being asked to talk to, you know, groups of head teachers and that kind of thing about how to harness the power actually of what they've got in their school and what you can do with it once you get that interwoven strength that starts kind of looking after itself. It can be very exciting. I think one of the things is if you I would say to anyone listening to this that I think is really important, it will depend on where you live on the planet, but certainly here, we're very seasonal. Just in my communications with my parents and my teachers and things, I'm always talking about the seasons with the children. You know, it's the solstice, what's the equinox, look what's growing, look how the trees have changed. And I just think that's the smallest thing you can do that can have a massive impact that people actually start noticing, because people don't notice trees. Mm. People just don't notice. They don't notice. you know, there's a tree outside your school. They'll be like, is there? and so I think that's a really powerful, tiny thing. So if anyone wants to do anything more, please can you, in your weekly newsletter or whatever, just go, oh, I really enjoyed seeing the cherry tree blossom this year in the garden. Yeah, because if you don't point it out to people, we're so detached from nature. And a lot of us live in quite urban situations where we don't see very many plants and the, you know, the shadows growing longer and all those kinds of things. I think it's a really easy thing to integrate into your communications, your assemblies, your meetings, and then suddenly people might just start noticing the real world that's there rather than the concrete.
I'm glad you said that, because I was just about to ask you that if you're a teacher within these school systems and you're bursting with energy to do something, like how would you find your way to speak out to your school community? Or if you're a head teacher and you're wanting to start to apply this, I mean, just what you said then is that perfect place to start, in the noticing and in the communication of that noticing, and in also bringing back that concept of time and you know, planting seed by seed, not trying to, like you said, do sweeping changes and say, I've got a much better idea than how this system's working, you know. That's just going to bring up the walls straight away, isn't it? It's about planting seeds in the different cracks and finding the spaces and calming down the system so that you can actually allow a new system to grow out of that. And you've answered all of that along the way. And I just thought, I wonder if there's any sort of final kind of thoughts that you can offer to teachers or to head teachers about how to move forward with this. If they don't have a Rebecca at their side to help push them along.
Well, in a school, on the noticing, is you must walk around it all the time. Mm-hmm. And you must... I don't like telling people what they must do. Actually, I always don't like doing that. But anyway, but in terms of a strong recommendation is walk around the school all the time and talk to the people that you instinctively don't want to have a conversation with. So if in the playground you just naturally go, oh, there's a parent that I could have a nice chat with, obviously say hello to them, but check yourself and talk to somebody else, because mm-hmm. otherwise you're going to miss out. And the same with the children. I noticed we did a project around girls and boys and stereotyping and gendering and all around that. And we all had to, you know, and I did it too with the staff. And we all had to make it's kind of action research in education, but, you know, make a commitment to make a change that looks like it's kind of evidence informed from some of the literature or some research that's happened. And my one was to talk to the boys more. So walking around the playground as the head teacher, often the girls would come up and go, oh, Miss Leek, and show me their acorn or something. And the boys would be playing football. And I, you know, and that is a scenario that often happens. So I didn't talk to the boys as much. Mm-hmm. And so I must make sure I have conversations with boys. And it was incredibly valuable. And mm-hmm. I learned more about the school because I didn't just talk to the girls. So walking around, making a really conscious effort to talk to the whole community, listening to them all. And if I may just add in as well, from a distance, so stand at the school gate and step away and look at the patterns of people coming in and coming out. I really love standing up in the first floor. I happen to have a school on two stories, not all schools are on two stories, and watching the playground from the second level. Mm. And then you really start noticing what's going on. So looking and engaging with everyone. I mean, and I what I would say to teachers as well, or people who are leaders or early leaders, or for want of a better expression, you know, early career, is trust me, everyone has a value. You might not know what it is, but everyone on your team will be incredibly important. Mm-hmm. And you just sometimes don't know it yet. So make sure you connect with everyone. There was an LSA at one of my schools, and she wasn't that great at spelling. And she wasn't that great at forming articulate sentences, let's say. And so people weren't necessarily supportive of her being an LSA. What they didn't know is that she was the LSA that would often reply to my whole staff emails and would often say, thank you so much for your email. It's really made a difference to my day. Mm-hmm. Or I really understood what you said there. Thank you. And so what they don't know is, as a head teacher, I needed her. I really needed her. And yes, she did need to make sure that she spelt things correctly if she was helping some children spell. And that's something that we can work on. But yeah. I needed her because she gave me a bit of feedback that I needed. And so there's a reason for everyone.
And yeah, the qualities and the value of everyone. Yeah. And building the relationship. Well, I certainly hope that you write this book that's on the boil, Unmuddied. Okay. Absolutely necessary, because you know, not only for schools and head teachers, but this approach of taking the way of thinking of the permaculture way of thinking and applying it as a lens to where whatever context that you're in. And so being able to conceptually, in a way, decouple it from the gardening to seeing it as this systems view of life, I think is really absolutely critical. So please do it.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today, Rebecca. I wish you all the best in your new role, rippling out that and planting lots of seeds, myceliating these ideas and connecting people in ways that they never knew possible before.
I'm very excited. It's January, so this is a kind of bubbling phase. So, yeah. We shall see.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Sense Making in a Changing World, a podcast of the Permaculture Education Institute. Check out the show notes below to find the link to Rebecca Leek, and also check out the notes for where to find details of all of our permaculture courses, our YouTube blog, free masterclasses and film clubs, and make sure you signed up to hear news and updates. And come and join us here at the Permaculture Education Institute to learn practical skills for designing and teaching permaculture and making a good livelihood while living a permaculture-inspired one planet way of life. Take care. I look forward to your company again next time.